The following recording was produced by Christ Redeemer Church of Hanover, New Hampshire. The speaker is Doug Cooper. You may find more information on the church and its various resources on the web at www.christredeemerchurch.org.
The word of the Lord today is Psalm 8. You'll find it on page 6 in your bulletin if you would like to follow along. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You have made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds, and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you, Mark. So what we're doing this morning is kicking off a short series of messages that I'll be sharing from the Psalms in the weeks to come, and they're all specifically concerned with one thing. They're concerned with the knowledge of God, and what I mean by that is, who is he? Who is he? How has he revealed himself to us? In what ways has he given us the opportunity to better know him, to better understand who he actually is? These are the kinds of questions that I want for us to take with us in these next few weeks. And then the question that should follow these sorts of questions, who is God? How has he revealed himself to us? Is how should that knowledge change us and the way that we live in light of it? And along the way, we're going to consider three separate things in this short series that I'm talking about here. This week, it'll be taken up with the knowledge of God in nature, specifically. Next week, we'll look at the knowledge of God in word. And then the last thing that we're going to look at is the knowledge of God in history. So for today, the knowledge of God in nature. And as we look at Psalm 8, I've got two things in mind, two things that present themselves to us here, two things that nature reveals to us about God. One is his greatness, and the other is his goodness. Okay, and that's what we're going to look at, his greatness and his goodness. Pretty simple, right? So his greatness, and one of the great things about Psalm 8 is that the point of this psalm is really not a difficult thing to sort out at all. You can almost see it at a glance because it's bookended by one very direct statement. You see it starting things off in verse 1, and then you see it closing things out in verse 8. It says, Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And everything that's sandwiched in between those two repeated statements is there to support that one statement. And so the idea that David is bringing across here in a very joyful and a very celebratory sort of a way is that you cannot go anywhere. You can't go anywhere in the whole entire world without being directly confronted with the reality of the utter majesty of God, of who he is. And if you were to look up this word majesty that's being used here, you would likely find two ideas that are being brought across. Okay, one expressing a kind of inherent dignity or a kind of inherent beauty that is in something. And then the other idea is expressing a possessed power that is in someone. A possessed power that's in someone. Often you would hear this word being used with royalty or something like that. But both of those ideas are intended in this psalm. And notice that it says, how majestic is your name in all the earth? Because, well, because a person's name means everything, right? I mean, this was especially true in times past, but a person's name means everything. You know, kind of like when you hear someone say, your reputation precedes you. You know, what do they mean by that? I hear your name and I have an idea or an expectation of who you are. And that might be a good thing. That might be a bad thing. It depends on the individual. It depends on the sorts of things that you associate with that name. But going right along with that, David gives us a very specific name and association. There's two uses of the name Lord that we've got in each of these repeated statements. One's in all caps. Do you see that? One's in all caps, and the other one isn't. The one that's not in caps simply means something like master, Lord, master. But the one written in all caps specifically means Yahweh. And this is not like a general sort of a name. This is a very specific name. It's the distinct name of the God of Israel. And the very first time that God revealed himself as Yahweh was in Exodus chapter 3. And you guys probably know this story. This is the scene in which God appears. He reveals himself, okay? He appears to Moses from the burning bush and commands him to go to Pharaoh and to bring the Israelites out of Egypt, to bring them out of captivity. And in response to that directive, what does Moses say to God? Do you guys remember? What does he say? He says, who am I? Who am I? Who am I to do this great thing in your name? Does that sound familiar? I mean, look at our psalm. We have something really similar to that here. What is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? Who are we? Who are we? And then, coming back to Moses, with a good helping of fear, Moses then asks, who should I say sent me? In what name should I go and do this thing in your name? And here's where God reveals himself as Yahweh. He says, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. There's no distinction to be made here. I am. I was. I always have been. I always will be. Nothing came into being that doesn't have its origin in me. I'm the self-sustaining one, and I sustain all things. All things depend upon me, and I depend on no one. All things live and breathe and have their being in me. I'm it. I am. And this is the name that David uses here. He's saying, your I am-ness, if I could put it that way, your I am-ness, God, is everywhere. We can't escape it. And it's majestic. It's inherently dignified and beautiful, and it's powerful. You are great. And speaking of this unparalleled greatness, David makes two references, to the heavens. In verse 1, he says, you have set your glory in the heavens. And then down a bit into verse 3, he says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of? I mean, whenever you see this word heavens, when you see it being used plurally, it almost always is referring to what is overhead, to what's above you, especially the night sky, because that's when it's nighttime, that's when God's greatness can like really pop. You know what I mean? That's when it's really on unique display. You know, you could argue, well, you know, come on, Doug, like what about sunsets? What about sunrises? And I really can't argue with you there. But like the thing is with a starry night, you get this deep sense of the vastness of God's creation that you can't get anywhere else. And that's what David is grabbing onto here. And nowadays, unlike David at this time, you would have to assume, we've got these incredible insights into just how remarkably vast this whole creation is. So let's just talk about stars for a little while, okay? Just so that we can get a better sense of the I am-ness of God and his creation. So I just read something about a discovery that scientists made back in 1995. Some of you guys may already know this stuff. I didn't. They had noticed this this little black section in the night sky where no stars could be seen. Okay, like even if you used like a standard common telescope, all you would see is just, you know, flat, solid blackness. And by the way, just to point out, like this was not a big black section in the sky, okay? In the article, they put it this way. They said, it covered the same amount of sky that a tennis ball would cover if it were 100 meters above you, which didn't completely help me when I read that. So I busted out my calculator and I did a little bit of math. And so this is what I figured out. So to understand how big this patch in the sky is, it'd be like if somebody went up on a 32-story building and like hung out over the edge and held up a tennis ball and you were on the ground looking up, okay? Up 32 stories, all right? That area of tennis ball that you could see from there, that's the spot of blackness that these guys were investigating, all right? You guys with me? All right. And so then what they did is they pointed their Hubble telescope at that tiny black dot in the sky. And they took a 10-day long exposure photo of it. They just kept the aperture open. And unfortunately, I can't show you this picture, so you'll just have to try to imagine it with me. But the photo isn't black by a long shot. It's almost like staring into a kaleidoscope that has like a black backdrop on it. It's got loads and loads of colors in specks in like glowing blobs and dots in this. You guys like my descriptive scientific, very scientific up right now. So, and what they explain about this photo is that everything that you see in that photo, these loads of specks and blobs and stuff like that, every little point, every little dot that you see is a whole entire galaxy. Like they could see it because there weren't stars in the way. And there were over 10,000 of them. Okay, so in this little tennis ball, there are 10,000 galaxies. And in each of these galaxies, there are 100 sextillion stars. Okay? That's a lot, right? That's a lot of stars, okay? And I'm not sure that I ever knew what a sextillion was before I read this article. And I mean, it's kind of like hard to imagine how accurate these things are. But here's the thing, like even if they were being dangerously liberal in their estimations, even if you came up with a much, much more conservative number, you would still have this like staggering number that describes a universe overhead that is like totally, completely vast beyond explanation. Now, in case I haven't like blown your minds, I got to back up here. There's something I didn't point out. So based on this photo of this, they did other estimations and they sorted out that there are 100 billion galaxies altogether. Okay, I did quote myself wrong. Based on this one photo, they figured out if you spread that out, there's 100 billion galaxies, and of those 100 billion galaxies, there's an estimated 100 sextillion stars. Okay, so there's still a lot of stars. Okay, yeah, all right. So now, in case that doesn't blow your mind, let me just throw out one more star story for you quickly. Have you guys ever heard of the VY Canis Majoris? Anybody? Nobody? Great. Okay. This is a star that is classified as a red hypergiant star. So these are like the largest stars, and this VY star is one of the bigger of these super big stars. And they estimate that if you were to stack up, so you take our sun, okay, which is humongous beyond comprehension, you take our sun and then you stack it on top of itself 1,420 times, and then you have the diameter of this VY Canis Majoris star. This is one star we're talking about, okay? And they estimate that if you took a plane, and planes go really fast, by the way, if you took a plane and you started flying around this thing, it would take you 1,100 years just to fly around it one time. That's how big this star is, okay? So that's one of these stars that I'm talking about, of these 100 sextillion stars. So, I mean, like, this is just beyond imagining, right? Like, seriously. I mean, it almost seems fictitious. Like, how could I even begin to comprehend the vastness that we're talking about? Like, Lord, who am I? What is mankind? In the face of all that, how could you be mindful of us? How could you care for us in the face of all that? So as we look out and we consider the work of his fingers, to put it David's way, and ask ourselves, who is God? How has God revealed himself to us? What does that tell us about him? Hopefully all that I just shared there gives us a sense of how majestically powerful God is. So that's some of his greatness. But now, where do we see his goodness at work? Where do we see his majestic dignity and beauty at work in the natural world? And this is where David's question of doubt and wonder becomes really helpful. Because there's a real irony to it. And that irony really begins to come through on the back end of this question. So take a look back with me, actually, at verse 4. And we'll just read this. What is mankind that you are mindful of them, human beings that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. And then get this here in verse 6. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. So what is David doing here? What he's doing here is he's taking his all the way back, okay? He's going all the way back. He's taking us back to Genesis chapter 1. Do you remember this? This is where God says, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And then it says this, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So first off, David is just reeling, okay? He's reeling at the majesty of God in the face of all of his creative power and wonder. Then he's reeling at the fact that God even considers us at all in light of all that. And then he's reeling at the fact that God involves us in these things, that he intentionally calls us to actually play a role and to participate and to oversee the works of his hands. And directly connected to that, it's because we're made in his image, because we're made in his likeness. Anthony Hokema, who was an American minister and professor, said that the most distinctive feature of the biblical understanding of man is the teaching that man, that humanity, has been created in the image of God. So he's saying that this idea that we're all made in the image of God is the most unique biblical teaching out there as it relates to us. The most unique. How we view ourselves, how we view and relate to one another, how we live and operate in the world. In other words, this idea that we're made in the image of God, this is like nothing to sneeze at. This is a really big deal as far as the Bible is concerned. So what does it mean? And what does it tell us about God? Because that's the question we're asking, right? What does it mean? What does it tell us about God? What does it mean that we've been made in God's image? And there's no way that we could plumb the depths of all that here this morning. There's a lot to it, more than we can get to here. But let's just spend some time thinking about it a little bit. And by the way, to be made in God's image, It isn't so much about appearance. It isn't so much about form. What it really has to do with is our nature. It has to do with our nature because we're a part of nature. When we heard the title, The Knowledge of God in Nature, we all likely thought of the natural world, and we probably weren't so quick as to think of ourselves as being a part of that natural world. We tend to think of ourselves as being apart from the natural world. And there's something to that, by the way. There's something to that. And one aspect of this is the fact that, wait a second. So we see ourselves as apart from the natural world, and yet we are a part of it. Simply by virtue of the fact that we've been created along with it, that we live and exist and are active within it. And yet, here's the thing. We have these undeniably distinctive features that we possess as people that cause us to somehow to truly stand apart from it all. And this is the part of who we are that is made in the image of God. And one aspect of this is the fact that we're deeply rational and relational creatures. Okay? We can be very irrational, mind you, right? We can be very relationally messy, mind you, but you can't be irrational without first being a rational human being, okay? You can't be relationally messy without first being a relational being, okay? We uniquely want to know things. We uniquely want to know others, and it's crazy. It's crazy that we can learn these things. It's crazy that we can take in such knowledge, that we can turn around and help others to do the same, that we can get involved in these complex processes, that we can experience these great feats of communication. And obviously technology comes to mind, when I say these things, but I don't just have technology in mind. I'm thinking relationally as well. The way that we relate to one another as rational creatures is an amazing thing. And we think nothing of this stuff most of the time because this is just all we know. This is what we do. This is just normal life. But it's an altogether amazing and unique thing. My dog can't do these kinds of things that I have in mind here, okay? Animal lovers, don't get up in arms on me here. Like, I am a fellow animal lover. We're on the same team, okay? I think about my dog, Shiloh. Like, man, I love that dog too much. We've been together for 15 years now. Our days are limited. I don't even like to think about it. Because why? Because I have this strange and wonderful connection with that creature. And I don't think it's a figment of my imagination. It might be, but I don't think it is. But there's a world of difference between her and I, though. There's a world of difference. She's not building tree forts, okay? She's not, like, thinking about how to solve global issues in the world. And she's got a lot of spare time, okay? I wish I had, like, a tenth of it. That's a dog's life, I guess. But all the time that we've spent together, Shiloh and I, we've never had, like, deep conversations together about the meaning of life. You know what I mean? We haven't talked about our place in the world. And I mean, we can laugh about it because it seems ridiculous, but that's the point. That's the point I'm trying to make here. There's a difference. And yet, there's something truly majestic about her. There's something wonderful and awe-inspiring about her. Without words, she communicates something to me about the greatness and the wonder of God, and that's the story that all creation is telling us all the time. It speaks of his greatness. It speaks of his goodness. But my dog and I are vastly different in ways that shouldn't be overlooked. Because David is made in the image of God because he's a rational and relational creature, he asks this question, ironically. What is mankind that you are mindful of him? Human beings that you care for him, care for them. I mean, he can only ask that question because he's made in God's image. And so what are the implications here? Where do we see his goodness? Where do we see it? Here's one. So by giving us dominion over the works of his hands, what's he doing? He's generously inviting us in. He's giving us meaningful work. He's given us ambition. He gives us responsibility. And in so doing, he gives us our dignity. Why? Because it's in his nature to do so. He is generous. He is dignified. And why do we gravitate towards these sorts of things? Why do we delight in the works of our hands? Because we share in his nature. He delights in the work of his hands. So do we, right? How else do we learn about the goodness of God here? Here's a question. As kids, when you guys were kids, did your parents have a lot of patience with you and take time to invite you into their work? And I'm sorry, kids, but here's the truth. It's hard work to get your kids involved in your work. It's hard work. Or at least it is initially, right? Because it's an investment. And it can be very challenging and time-consuming. You can get a lot more done if you don't invite them in. You can get things done faster. And so if you had parents who took the time to slow down and involve you in what they were doing, they were probably really good parents. Okay? And are you guys tracking with me on this? So we can't forget the greatness of God. Don't forget the I am-ness of God. He's the self-sustaining one. He depends upon no one. He doesn't need us. We're not lightening his load by having dominion over the works of his hands. He never tires. His strength is inexhaustible. He spoke the world into being, which can only mean one thing, that he's good. That if he doesn't need us, that can only mean that he wants us. Okay? He must simply delight in us, delight in the works of his hands, that he delights to generously invite us in, to invest in us in order to see us thrive and to experience that sense of dignity that is one with his nature. Here's another thing that we learn about God here, is that he delights in using weak things to accomplish great things. This is why David is saying, in light of your great power, what is mankind that you would even give us the time of day? Let me just sneak in one more star fact. You guys okay with that? One more star fact. All right. So I talked about the big stars. Those are the red hypergiants. They've also got these smaller stars that they call neutron stars. And what scientists have learned about them is that these stars are outrageously dense, crazy dense. They say that just one teaspoon of a neutron star contains the same amount of mass as 100 great pyramids of Giza. Here's another way of describing that, okay? To try to get our heads with this. If you were to take a Boeing 747 jet, to get the density, to match the density of one of these stars, you would have to take that Boeing jet and crush it down and compact it until it was the size of one grain of sand. That's how dense these stars are, okay? So dense, indestructible dense. And then here we are, okay? We're so ridiculously tiny in comparison to the kinds of things that I'm talking about here, and we're a bunch of walking, talking bags of water, all right? That's what we are, okay? So even if I was 7 feet tall, and even if I was totally jacked, so that I had to cut all the sleeves off of all my shirts, just so that I could get my arms through them, and I'm almost there, but I'm not there yet. But even then, I would hardly have, if I was 7 feet tall and totally jacked like Arnold Schwarzenegger, even then, I would not be dense at all, because I'm a walking, talking bag of water. I can so easily get squished, all right? So why me? This tiny balloon within this vastness of your creation, why would you think of me? Why would you care about me, God? And this is what we know about God from his creative design, that he delights to make much of weak things. He delights in that. We learn that from his creation. The Apostle Paul made this same point when he was writing to the church in Corinth. He said, "The foolishness of God is wiser than men. The weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong." And you get a really good example of this right here in Psalm 8. And it's a tough verse to make sense of until you connect it with Jesus. So look at verse 2 in our psalm. It says, "Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger." Kind of confusing, right? But this is one of the verses that Jesus quoted during his earthly ministry. And if you were with us when we worked through the Gospel of Mark, you might remember this scene. This is the scene with the donkey and with the palm branches, what we often commonly call Jesus' triumphal entry. He rides into Jerusalem for the first time on the back of a baby donkey, a colt. And he's led, not across a red carpet, right? He's led across a carpet of coats and branches. These are weak things, right? He comes into Jerusalem, and everyone is saying, "Who is this?" And some say, "This is a man from Nazareth." And remember that, what is Nazareth? Nazareth is a small, nobody town. Weak. And then he begins to exercise his authority and to forcefully cleanse the temple. Moving over tables, driving people out. He's saying, "My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you're making it a den of robbers." And then, if you look at this in Matthew's account, this is what you read next. This is where we're moving in on verse 2. "And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he had done, and the children who were shouting in the temple, 'Hosanna to the Son of David,' they became indignant and said to him, 'Do you hear what these children are saying?' And Jesus said to them, 'Yes. Have you never read, 'Out of the mouth of infants and nursing babies, you have prepared praise for yourself.' And he left them and went out of the city to Bethany and spent the night there." He delights to do great and dignified things through small things and weak things. And the crazy thing about what the gospel teaches us is that he intentionally took on our nature. That in his goodness, he set aside his greatness and he became a small thing and a weak thing within the vast universe that he'd created. He became a vulnerable, walking, talking bag of water. He took on our flesh and he dwelt among us. In fact, if you come over into Hebrews chapter 2, the author quotes verses 4 through 6 from Psalm 8. Like, this psalm is getting quoted all over the place. Hebrews 2 quotes it. And the author, after quoting verses 4 through 6, draws the conclusion that all the things that we actually fail at in our weakness, all the ways that we fail to rule and to have dominion in our world and in our own lives, that through weakness, Jesus came in order to fulfill and redeem all of that stuff. And here's how the author concludes it. He says, "But we do see Jesus." This should sound familiar from Psalm 8. "But we do see Jesus, who is made lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone." He came to fulfill it and redeem it. All things. And the knowledge of that, knowing these things about God, ought to change the way that we live and relate to everything. It ought to change the way that we live and relate to our work, to one another, to his creation. In fact, it's meant to bring dignity to even the most undignified things in the world. Here's an example. Martin Luther, important figure in the English Reformation, he discovered this for himself. He said, "Leave the works in one class. Consider one as good as another." So in other words, when you know this God, when you know this gospel, all work becomes holy, no matter what it is. One is not classier than the other. So let me read that quote in full now. Leave the works in one class. Consider one as good as another. Fear God and be just, as has been said. And then do whatever comes before you. This way, all will be well done, even though it is no more than loading manure or driving a mule. In other words, knowing the greatness and the goodness of God redeems all of our work, and it leads to our best work, because we can really be free in it, because we know that he has invited us into it. It can become a way for us to identify with him. It can be a way for us to responsibly worship him. And in it, we find our inherent dignity. We're most human when we know these things. We're most compassionate. It can lead us into a totally different relationship with all aspects of life, all aspects. Jonathan Edwards, the famed American preacher and author from the 1700s, he had this kind of an experience where his relationship with, ironically, with the created world was totally flipped on its head. He said, and you can read this in the Time of Reflection, he said, scarce anything, this is really cool, scarce anything among all the works of nature was so sweet to me as thunder and lightning. Do you guys have this experience? Formerly, nothing had been so terrible to me. Before, I used to be uncommonly terrified with thunder and to be struck with terror when I saw a thunderstorm rising. But now, on the contrary, it rejoiced me. I felt God, so to speak, at the first appearance of a thunderstorm and used to take the opportunity at such times to fix myself in order to view the clouds and see the lightnings play and hear the majestic and awful voice of God's thunder, which oftentimes was exceedingly entertaining, leading me to sweet contemplations of my great and glorious God. While thus engaged, it always seemed natural to me to sing or chant for my meditations or to speak my thoughts in soliloquies with a singing voice. Does he sound like a weirdo to you? He was. He was. He was a really strange man, okay? He was a weirdo of the highest and most dignified order. This is what a knowledge of God is meant to do to us. It's meant to radically affect our entire relationship with the world around us to the benefit of the world, okay? Weirdos. Would you guys pray with me? Father, what wonderful things to contemplate. Lord, oh Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. We're surrounded. We can't escape it. And somehow, God, we're dull to these things. They're just too familiar. We just take them for granted. We don't really see the symbolism in them. We don't really hear what they're really declaring to us. We don't see beneath them to your glory. We don't see the precious things that they say to us about you and what it means for us. So God, would you give us eyes to see? Would you help us to really comprehend both your greatness and your goodness, most especially demonstrated to us in the person of Jesus Christ? In his name we pray. Amen.